You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are.
All right. So we are going, we are in subsection 21 of section 110 of Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. We're on page 170. Again, subsection 21. So let's get rolling.
21. The last scions and consequences of Platonism in the present. A. Everything that calls itself ontology and everything that wants to be or does not want to be ontology, even its oppositions, e.g. the one based on a Kantianism, remain within the same realm of conditions for ontologies. B. All Christian and non-Christian metaphysics. C. Every theory that adopts values, meaning ideas and ideals, likewise, the theories, positivism and biologism, that deny these. D. Any kind of life philosophy to which the question of being, even in the proper form of the earlier guiding question, remains alien. Dilthey. E. Every single one of those trends that mix up all of the above, teach ideas and values, and at the same time emphasize existence in the matter of life philosophy. Here the most extreme confusion is raised to a principle, and all genuine thinking and questioning is abandoned. F. Finally, Nietzsche's philosophy, which precisely because it understands itself as an inversion of Platonism, refalls into it through the back door, so to speak. Even where Nietzsche, as a thinker who goes over, does ultimately twist free from Platonism and from its inversion, he still does not achieve an originary interrogation of the truth of being and of the essence of truth. An interrogation that would lead to an overcoming.
Yeah. So all these things remain scions and consequences of Platonism, which I think really, in a sense, means they cling to the idea or the form as reality and avoid investigating truth and bang and the truth of bang. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I feel like he named like everything.
Pretty much everything.
I was like, wait, what did he name?
Everybody except him, yeah. all liberals in general, all liberal sciences, the entire philosophical heritage of liberalism, yeah, is all there. Yeah, well, let's keep rolling on.
Okay, yeah. 22. On the other hand, Nietzsche was the first to recognize the key position of Plato and the bearing of Platonism on the history of the West, ascent of nihilism. More precisely, he had an intimation of the key position of Plato. For Plato's position between pre-Platonic and post-Platonic philosophy becomes visible only if the pre-Platonic is grasped out of itself in a primordial way and not, as in Nietzsche, interpreted platonically. Nietzsche remained mired in this interpretation because he did not recognize the guiding question as such and did not carry out the transition to the basic question. Yet Nietzsche did, and this, for the moment, has greater weight. Yet Nietzsche did, and this for the moment has greater weight, track down Platonism in its most covert forms. Christianity and its secularizations are thoroughly Platonism for the people.
Yeah, Christianity and its secularizations, which means liberalism, are Platonism for the people.
Secularization is just like supposedly non-religious religiosity.
Yeah, exactly. And like we said before, there's a lot of writing on how liberalism is just kind of secularized Christianity. Yeah. With its emphasis on charity and the weak and salvation and guilt and all these Christian forms put into the civic and secular worlds.
Are there any particular writers on that? That's kind of an interesting topic.
There's a couple books I've read that talk about that. One is called A World After Liberalism by Matthew Rose, which is actually kind of a compendium of conservative writers over the 20th century, Spengler, Evola, Yaki, Benoit, Francis. And there's a lot of talk in there about Christianity's morphing into liberalism. And the other is, it's called The Conservative Mind by Russell Kirk. So yeah, anyhow, we should keep reading, huh? Where were we?
So that was 22.
That was 22, yeah. So, I mean, I think the very strong linkage that is being made here is between is the long arc of Platonism from, you know, an ancient Greek philosophy to Christianity to liberalism. And so as we talk about Platonism and we talk about the aspects of it, its idealism, its realism, its forms, its essences, its emphases, we are performing an epistemological archaeology on liberalism itself.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. 23. In its overt and covert dominance, Platonism has placed beings as a whole and in the way they have been considered and been formed during the course of Western history into a definite condition and has turned definite directions of representation into self-evident ways of questioning. Cf. above transcendence. That is the genuine impediment to experiencing and leaping into Dasein, and it is so severe that at first Dasein is not understood, especially since the necessity of its grounding does not become clear on account of the lack of need for such a necessity. This lack, however, is based in the abandonment by being as the deepest mystery of the current history of Western humanity.
Yeah, so we return to that phrase, abandonment by being.
I've missed that phrase.
Have you?
Yeah. Hasn't been around in a while.
And yeah, he's defining Platonism as something that has placed beings into a definite condition and has turned definite directions of representation into self-evident ways of questioning, cf. Above transcendence. For instance, thinking about transcendence, questioning, which is sort of what liberals view as question-worthy, what liberals view as unquestionable. There is a sense that one gets from liberals that there is a kind of Platonic ideal that they're holding on to that kind of governs their inquiries and their rationality and their epistemology and their assessment of social value, social order. They're not ones. And we heard just last night in that book we were listening to in the car, where he's talking about, you know, the principle of competition in global economics that is a long-standing inheritance of neoliberalism, and as he points out there, that due to competition being an ideology of liberalism, when you question whether it has positive or negative effects or outcomes, liberals who are inherently ideological sort of say that's irrelevant, because mm-hmm. as long as the economy is abiding by the ideology, then it's on track to create the ideal world that our ideology foresees. We have an interesting thing here. The genuine impediment to experiencing and leaping into Dasein is apparently these self-evident ways of questioning, this Platonism that positions beings according to a representation and a self-evident way of questioning, right? So, mm-hmm. so leaping into Dasein this is a post-liberal positioning, a post-liberal praxis, and the Platonism of liberalism is so severe that Dasein is not understood, and its grounding is not clear, and this is on account of the lack of a need for such a necessity. So liberalism does not even see the necessity for Dasein, for a repositioning of the human spirit outside of Platonism. And this lack of need for such a necessity is based in the abandonment by being as the deepest mystery of the current history of Western humanity. Abandonment by being, meaning, you know, the culmination of Platonism, or the outlay of Platonism as liberalism, is that we have been abandoned by being, or we have abandoned being. Being has abandoned us, because Platonic forms and values and ideas and ideals and ideologies and representations are where reality is held to exist, and beings are, in a sense, null and void. Yeah?
Yeah, can you go over what the genuine impediment to experiencing and leaping into Dasein is again, please? Or maybe, like,
yeah, well, he says,
explain it a little more.
In its overt and covert dominance, Platonism has placed beings as a whole into a definite condition and has turned definite directions of representation into self-evident ways of questioning. So,
yeah. So it's like the ways of questioning, or self, the ways of, he puts questioning in quotes.
Yeah, how we question, what we question, yeah. What is question worthy, what beings are considered questionable and what are considered givens and as assumed and unquestionworthy. I mean, he says there that he has placed beings into a definite condition. Mm-hmm. So beings exist in a state, a defined state, a sort of a liberally mandated ontic realm of mm-hmm. how we're to understand what is happening in the world and what there is. And directions of representation, so where representation begins, where it ends, where it's supposed to go, what it is relevant to, and that these become self-evident ways of questioning. This is sort of, I would mm-hmm. say, a touchback to the science conversation and, mm-hmm. and liberalism's how should we say, one-track mind in terms of how questions and progress and inquiry and research and philosophy is to be conducted, right? Mm-hmm. Within the service of liberal goals, liberal ideals, liberal values, and questioning that steers clear of that, or doesn't abide by that path mark, is unacceptable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's
and these self-evident ways of questioning are the greatest impediment to experiencing and leaping into Dasein.
Yeah.
Because if you have self-evident ways of questioning, then there are questions you can't even conceive of as being relevant, valuable, or even rational. There are things that are just unquestionable, unquestionworthy, and you can't even ask them. And when you do ask them, you sound like some kind of philosophical kook.
Mm-hmm.
And this prevents Dasein, because Dasein is, in a sense, putting yourself into a position of questioning.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a sense, it's becoming a question. It's becoming appropriated by events and Bang, which renders a whole new host of questions that liberalism's directional representational regime doesn't even really conceive as valid language.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's because due to the covert and overt dominance of Platonism in liberalism, or liberalism as Neoplatonism, there's no being where Dasein might be.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really seen as somebody who's lunging at phantoms and trying to breed with fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to breed with ghosts and absences and ciphers, and so you're just kind of loony and off course, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it is actually, I kind of wanted to revisit this one section above, which I feel like fits in really well here. It was 21E.
Please.
Where it said, it's talking about every single one of those trends that mix up all of the above, teach ideas and values, and at the same time emphasize existence in the manner of life philosophy. Here, the most extreme confusion is raised to a principle, and all genuine thinking and questioning is abandoned. I thought that last sentence was nice, because I feel like that's
liberalism.
That's anxiety.
That's government as therapy. That's,
yeah.
That's consciousness as community. That's representation as reality.
Yeah.
Right. That's values totally. As validity. That's progress as necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And with the dominance of values and the dominance of identity, because all of those things, you know, if you look at these things, every theory that adopts values, meaning, ideas, and ideals,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
These are the trappings of identity, the dressings of identity, the characters and the players of identity. Values are what he means by values is essentially like you identify as a person of values, and that you have values, and your values imbue your identity with value, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning is obviously basically a catalog of identities. Ideas are identities. Ideals are identities. And the theories that deny these do so only by an inversion similar to Nietzsche's, where you just kind of carry out the same metaphysical praxis but in an inverted sense. And then we have this life philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
To which questions of being remain alien. Again, mm-hmm. avoiding the question of being, what is, and just kind of, I mean, God, I was thinking about that yoga retreat we did in Mexico.
Yeah.
And this really seems like pertinent to that. And I was thinking how just alienated and estranged I felt from mm-hmm. everyone on that retreat. And I was thinking this morning, why was I so estranged? And I think it was because they all seemed to have this very fervid life philosophy that was allergic to the question of being.
Mm.
It it was allergic in the sense that it was really aggressively in avoidance of the question of being, meaning it was far more orgasmically fixated on developing characters and accoutrements of its life philosophy in order to remain in some kind of plastic ecstatic state and to mean something and be valuable and live the yoga ideal. But
yeah, there was like an established script of what was the yoga ideal and how people related to it.
Right. And so what Heidegger would say is like, you know, that is just a very superficial way of thinking, and it should be replaced with committed, recurrent daily questions of being. Yeah. Which, you know, I think it's worthwhile that, say something. You were on that trip, so is there something more you want to say about those people and what was going on and what that life philosophy is?
No, but the one thing I want to mention is I feel like I felt that this morning, actually, when I had this mom's Zoom.
You had a Zoom with some moms.
The nurture community of moms.
Oh, right.
And I was listening to moms talk about sleep and their children, and it was just like, honestly, it was just like one after another of people saying exactly what they were supposed to say, which is like, you know, I love sleeping with my kid, but it can be hard sometimes. And then like all this other stuff about how good it is, but I can get a little frustrated. And it was just like, I actually left the meeting early, which I've never done, because I was just so like, I just felt like I was listening to a script.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah.
Yeah. So I was standing.
Yeah, you listened in on a little bit of it.
10
and I was
feet
embarrassed.
From the microphone listening. And I had to really put handcuffs on my face to like not jump in. Because what you were talking about was co-sleeping versus sleep training.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get to a point with a child, the child is often 4 or 5 months. And you've been sleeping in the bed with them, you've been nursing them, it's been working, the child nurses, maybe goes back to sleep for a couple hours, nurses again. And then there's always this time where the wake-ups just start getting more frequent. Because the child is becoming more cognizant, and any flicker of light, any noise, any movement in the bed stimulates them. Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, consciousness is becoming more frequent. And so then they start reaching for the boob and groping around and grabbing, and then you nurse them thinking, oh, they'll sleep again, but they wake up another half hour, and you start to go mentally ill.
Yeah, basically it's like you think the baby is sleeping longer and longer stretches, but then both times for us, it just goes completely backwards at some point. And yeah, it's like every half an hour they wake up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on my fourth child.
Yeah, is that the same way?
Every single one has done that. So then you have, you know, so you have these camps, co-sleeping versus sleep training, and you know this could be liberal post-liberal. I mean, this is quintessential stuff here. You know, in the co-sleeping camp, it's that, you know, you want to be close to your child, you want them to have mom time, parent time, you want them to be warm. There's all this stuff about how, like, in the primitive days, families slept together, and, you know, on and on. And it would be cruel to do anything but. So you basically fall to pieces. Yeah. And not only does, like, the mom start to fall to pieces, because she's not getting much sleep. Maybe the dad's getting more sleep because he's like on the other side of the bed with like four pillows on his head, or he ends up in the other room, exactly, because he's got to get up for work, or he's going to get up early with the kids and let the mom catch up on sleep, whatever. And then your marriage starts to fall apart, and you know, and it's all, again, it's all
principle.
It's all based on an ideology that this is kindness, this is charity, this is love, this is what a baby needs. Mm-hmm. Then you get to sleep training, which, I mean, for quite a while now, I would say like 3 decades, 4 decades, has been seen as a barbaric, conservative, draconian measure. Mm-hmm. And that's basically you teach the child to sleep on its own. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, you know, which is seen as brutal because you're separating the child. The child is screaming. The child is crying. The child's not getting what it needs. You're cruel. You're patriarchal. You're ripping the child from its mother, you know, and it is often the dad who carries it out because mm-hmm. the point is kind of telling the child that like mom's not a 24-hour bar, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like the original Oedipal scene, you know? I mean, it is.
Yeah, it's true.
Where the child wants to be with its mom and the dad becomes the evil, giant, hairy no. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was standing 10 feet from listening to these one liberal woman after another just be like, really what I was struck by was just how pacified and incompetent and almost like self-negated they seemed. Mm-hmm. Like they, mm-hmm. it seemed like they were literally stuck. Yeah. And they were stuck between, you know, it's becoming hell to not get any sleep, but they can't bring themselves to like sleep train because that's seen as like a post-liberal evil. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to walk into the microphone and go, you have to take that baby. You need to give it to your man. He needs to bring it down into another room somewhere. And he needs to sleep with it night after night. And when it cries, he pats its back and he says it's going to be fine. And after a week, that baby will be sleeping through the night every time. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, that's not cruelty. Mm-hmm. That's just reality. Mm-hmm. But to liberalism, that's cruelty. And that's just part and parcel of liberalism's sense that forcing somebody to follow the law is cruelty.
Right.
Punishing someone for a crime is cruelty. Giving someone a C instead of an A is cruelty. Making people take tests is cruelty. Saying no to your child when they've got caught up in some kind of thing online and now they want to do something insane is cruelty. You know, I mean, it's just liberal. I mean, and, you know, and that's sort of part of, you know, liberalism's obsession is with overturning hierarchies and authority, mm-hmm. and negating the authority that it has. Liberals don't want to have any authority. Mm-hmm. So sleep training is authority. And they just really are allergic and averse to an exercise of authority. Everything falls apart.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. Everything falls apart.
Yeah. But the thing is, I'm not sure if it was pure sleep training, because I think pure sleep training is when you literally leave the baby in the room and you just leave the room for 12 hours.
No, I don't know about that. You know, there's a very famous book.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are lots of variations.
It used to be called Ferberizing Your Child.
Right?
It used to be called Ferberizing, because the guy who wrote the book, his name is Ferber. Ferber Sleep Training Book. The Ferber Sleep Training Book. It's called Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems by Richard Ferber. And it literally used to be called Ferberizing.
Yeah.
You know that. And you know what? If you were to read that book, it's not stick your child in a dark room and go on vacation.
Yeah.
That's not at all what it is, actually. Mm-hmm. But it does require some no. Mm-hmm. It requires some no. And liberals are all yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Until, and again, liberal indulgence in empathy for others just results in suicide and their own suffering. Mm-hmm. That's clear. That's given. That's God's odd. Yeah. You know? And if there were only liberals in this world, it would be long gone.
Yeah.
It would be gone because it would eat itself. Because I've seen mothers can get eaten alive by their infants if they can't say no.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I've diatribed enough.
Yeah.
But it's very symptomatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really wanted to jump on the mic and say, ladies, you have to snap out of it.
Well, I said it in my like nice way, I thought, but I don't know. I mean, it probably wasn't forceful enough. But I did. I mean, I told our story.
The thing that makes me sad about it is, I mean, let's be public about this. I've been married twice.
Yeah.
And in my first marriage, I was not allowed to sleep train the children.
Mm-hmm.
My instinct to do so was mocked and refused.
Mm-hmm.
And so both my first daughters were in my bed for 4 years each.
Mm-hmm.
8 years. Okay? You let me do it, and I believe you're grateful.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say it was hard to like let you do it, but
right.
It was like I didn't enjoy it. I don't, you know, no. I probably should have like, I don't know, somehow thought about it more. Like I didn't realize what a big deal it is, but I mean, it's incredible. Our children sleep through the night. I mean, it's like now if we ever get woken up, we're like cranky about it.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is we have a pretty nice situation.
Yeah.
Because I was able to take the kid down to the yurt.
Yeah.
Which is a good 50 yards from the house.
Yes, definitely.
And you didn't hear them.
That's true.
If you'd heard them, you might have cracked.
That's true.
You might have cracked. Yeah. Now, most people don't have that option.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I was like, how do you even sleep? I mean, and I literally can't even imagine doing it in a New York City apartment.
Yeah. And so, you know, but I don't know. It's a deeper issue.
Yeah, But yes,
isn't it just about, isn't that classic sort of setting boundaries?
Yeah, it is.
It's about setting boundaries and mm-hmm. saying, you know, it's really, I mean, the first no that a child gets is mommy is not a 24-hour bar.
Yeah.
The government, mandates that mommy close from 2 a.m. to 8 a.m.
Yeah.
And you can't have a drink. And it's the first no, and it's a terrible no.
Yeah.
And it is edible. The father is forever after, seen as the great denier. And that is that's a burden that fathers bear, but mothers bear a burden too, because mothers are obviously complicit in it.
Yeah.
Like, why doesn't mom like kill dad
mm-hmm.
and say, take my boobies. That evil man was between you and my boobies. And I mm-hmm. wanted you there, you know, so mm-hmm. both are complicit. And I think children know that. And I think that it's, it, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah. I think, what was particularly interesting, and what was particularly interesting about this group was like I was talking about that, but that was in like a small group. It was like a small group within a big group. I haven't, like, I didn't. Well, I don't know. I was not able to because I didn't want to, or I didn't feel like it was appropriate to just say that in like the bigger group and just be like, well, actually a great solution is sleep training. Not like that's a really good solution. So I think it was just that was not there was no room for an alternative to the dominant narrative, which is based on the belief or the principle of nurturing children, which babies, nurturing babies and providing them comfort. Which overall I like that idea, but I also think that it's not actually across the board, that there can be times when you do that and times that you don't do it. Or I don't know. I'm not sure if it's really fair to say that sleep training is not nurturing actually, but
that's right. I think that's a good point because I must say, you know,
'cause they sleep so much better, I imagine.
Oh, they sleep so much better.
Incredible. And we sleep better and everyone's happier.
and what sleep training was actually like, you know, to dispel the brutality myth, I lay there and the baby would go to sleep and we'd both sleep for a little while and then the baby would wake up crying for the boob and I would rub her back and pat her back
mm-hmm.
and until
her sucker thumb.
Yeah, she went to sleep, and I taught her to self-soothe. Yeah. I introduced her to herself.
Yeah.
I said, hey, guess what?
Yeah.
You're here. You are strong, and you can be with yourself, and you can comfort yourself. And the bed is soft, and the pillow is nice, and your pajamas are nice. And this hand is on your back. And she knew I was there.
Yeah.
They always know that. Now, I don't have what they want, but they knew I was there.
Yeah.
And it didn't take long. It took a few nights. Then there was a little backsliding for a few nights, and then more training, and then pretty soon. I mean, you remember the feeling where it was like, we put them to sleep, and 9 hours later, we'd wake up and go, good God.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Except actually, I still woke up every couple hours, but eventually it was like day by day, I would be able to sleep another hour. But yeah, eventually it was like.
So my point is liberalism.
No, you're right. That it was very kind.
Paints these stark differences as if there's nurturing and then there's you know, torture chamber.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's not what it is at all.
I really like how you just said it, that you introduced her to herself, and that she can calm herself. She has the capacity. She has the strength. She has everything she needs.
Right.
She doesn't need mommy.
That's right.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's probably worthwhile now to just like kind of, you know, it's just kind of a obvious platitude, but, you know, in this liberal post-liberal landscape, the shift out of liberalism and the shift away from liberalism. And I hesitate to say this, but there is this odd male-female thing going on, you know? Now, I want to make clear that I'm not saying at all that there are, you know, instinctual identitarian essences to males and females that link them up with some particular political position. I don't actually believe that. I mean, I think that, you know, and it's obviously on a spectrum, you know, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's all this stuff, you know, now about, you know, the feminization of society, you know? And frankly, if you go and look at the post-liberal landscape, it's pretty largely male. There are women in there too, big, important women in that scene, writers and thinkers, and I mean, big ones, Barry Weiss and all these, you know, Laura Loomer, and I think Libs of TikTok is run by a woman. And
I'm not sure they're really post-liberal, but... Are you saying conservative or post-liberal?
No, they're anti-liberal.
Anti-liberal, okay.
Yeah. Anti-liberal.
Okay.
I mean, whatever, post-liberal, I don't know what those are, but okay. I guess I'm just saying, I think the reason I want to bring it up is like, you know, I mean, maybe there is some truth in, I've been in two marriages, and I would say I was in one marriage with a very liberal woman, it was horrible for a lot of reasons, but one reason I would say is that the mom's approach to everything was unquestionably the only approach that there was. Mm-hmm. It was not a collaboration. It was not a male-female household. It was not a yin-yang. It was not a balance. It was not a conversation. And it wasn't a conversation by and large because there was a political and I would say ideological determination that the female is more important, more informed, and more prescient in terms of how things should go with children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I sound like I'm whining, but it's not really, it's more that, I don't know. What am I saying?
Yeah, I think you're just saying that having a balance, having both influences is important and collaborating is important.
Yeah, well,
it might be sort of easy or natural for me to say, yes, nurture all the way 100%. But like actually, well, questioning isn't nurture, really. And then also just there are other ways that also totally work, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a philosophy podcast where I'm always trying to be profound, but honestly, like I just find myself just feeling like saying things like, you know, things that I just read on X, you know, like the male has been kicked out of the home, you know, yeah. That the importance of the father has been completely denigrated and decimated by a feminized liberalism. And, you know, I don't know, like, I want to be very careful in saying that kind of stuff because I'm not like some kind of, I don't know, alpha male man advocate or anything. But I respond to some of it. I mean, I think only because I guess in my second marriage, with you know who, I've experienced this balance where we both talk about our perspectives, and our perspectives coming from who we are respected and listened to, and then we try to determine which, you know, whether we're going to lean the scale a little to the left or lean the scale a little to the right. You know what mm-hmm, I mean? Mm-hmm. And there's no kind of supposition of primacy, or there's no battle for power.
And I feel like, I mean, I've been feeling this a bit, and I have this one Instagram, a coaching where I am a social media coach, and so I follow coaches. And there's a lot of like, and it's not just in coaching, but it's like, you know, I can't even think of what the phrases are, but you know, you're a woman, don't let anyone talk down to you, stand your ground. I don't know, just like all these really
female empowerment
phrases.
Affirmations, yeah.
And I think, and actually it's actually reminding me of something else I saw today. There's a coach who did like who supposedly, you know, makes like $1 million in a week and like had a very big live launch, and she live event, and she like incredibly huge production, and she's incredibly successful. And she just shared a video of herself talking at this live event that probably cost $10,000 for anybody to go to, and it had 150 women there. And she basically shared, she was like, I've had depression for a long time. And then she went on to talk a little about depression and how talking to her female friends who were there had really helped her, and how she, I guess, broke free from it. And it was bizarre to see, because it was like, I was trying to figure out how she was getting value, because coaches only do things that give them value, like what the value was she was getting from that. And it reminds me of all this, because there's the sort of life philosophy, the idea of needing to, that it was her talking with her other female friends that gave her the importance of unburdening and talking it through with other people and sharing it. But then it also just kind of spreads this story. And then also just the shared, I feel like we've developed this very big shared narrative of depression and anxiety that I don't know if it has anything to do with reality other than the language that's used.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that I was making that, I thought of that partly because I hear the most extreme confusion is raised to a principle and all genuine thinking and questioning is abandoned. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me too, or it's making me think just also of just the sort of feminist mantras in general, these, the nurture parenting, it just all feels very, well, principled. And then, but I guess how does it become something extreme confusion raised to a principle? And I feel like there's something like you know, I feel like a big part of why depression and anxiety is supposedly so much more prevalent and bigger is because it's talked about. So everyone now has these shared narratives.
Well, it's been raised to a principle.
Yeah. And it's quite easy to be like, oh yeah, that's what I'm feeling. That's right. Maybe that's what I'm feeling. And then you kind of get right into it. So that's a bit of a taking it somewhere else, but
no, that's amazing.
I feel like it's related.
It really is. I mean, extreme confusion raised to a principle is really a great way to paraphrase and describe, you know, the way that, let's say, mental health or anxiety or depression or anything that someone considers to be their defect, mm-hmm, is raised to a principle. Now, what do we mean by principle there? What it means is it's raised to the ideal and the ideology and the value and the meaning that people can have with each other.
Yeah.
And it's how people gain a sense of importance and bonding, and it's the gasoline in the identity machine.
Mm-hmm.
It gives the identity the glue and the hyper connectivity that it needs to form ever larger networks of empathy and sharing, and relatedness, and ultimately just identitarian movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, what she was getting by doing that, what she was saying to her followers, you know, I'm weak like you.
Yeah.
I'm messed up like you, but you have saved me like I have saved you. Mm-hmm. And now we are in this unbreakable bond,
mm-hmm,
of mental illness.
Yeah.
And if we leave each other, we will all commit suicide.
Yeah.
So we have to stay together.
Yeah.
In this kind of, you know, coven, right?
Yeah, and this, yeah.
Yeah.
And that gets back to the, like, saying the right thing in a group, back to the yoga class, like, just, or the yoga retreat, just this idea that it was, like, there's one way to experience, you know, the correct feeling of being there-ness or something. I don't know. The correct yogic feeling of meditation and enjoying your time, yeah, there is like, there was really, yeah, no other way of speaking that was allowed in the space without you seeming, right, like an asshole, basically.
Right.
I think you successfully did, as I recall.
Yeah. That's another story.
Sorry.
But, I think that that's, you know, it's such a vast topic. I find myself at a loss for words, sort of male, female sexuality in the family, in culture, in politics, how those dichotomies line up with different agendas and histories and presences and how they negotiate the personal and the political and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's heavy, mm-hmm, but I think that the reason that feminism is completely whack and needs to go away is the same reason that masculinism, whatever that is, and there's masculinism. I mean, I think right now it's all, because everything is through a liberal lens, it's called toxic masculinity, or it's called the manosphere, or it's called mansplaining, or it's called the alpha male, you know, alpha male psychosis, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that's
basically mean words.
Yeah, well, that's because it's liberalism,
yeah.
And so, you know, feminism is a glorious word, and masculinism doesn't even exist in a word as a word. It's just all these other pejorative terms for men feeling strong about themselves, and but be that as it may, you know, if there is such a thing as masculinism, and I think we all kind of have a sense of what masculinism is and what feminism is, they're isolated identitarian power grabs. And my response to each of them would be, well, I don't know, I guess you got to get into a relationship with someone of the opposite sex, and the two of you got to figure out how much female and how much male you want in that situation. And the isms that you bring to that are just going to make that negotiation that much harder and that much less genuine.
Yeah.
Right? Like I haven't come into a relationship with you as a masculinist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I've come in with my instincts, my inclinations, my insights, my experiences, my sense of what is right, my sense of what is wrong, most of which, all of which probably, are laced with doubt and wonder and maybe, and you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I've just tried to be myself
mm-hmm.
with you. I didn't bring any isms into it. You didn't bring any isms into it. And that has resulted in a long form conversation. As I've said, we have a talking problem.
Yeah.
Right? We talk everything through extensively. And I think that is our process of trying to, I mean, in a corny way, bring the male and female together to guide a family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in the end, the only thing that can be said about the role of the female and the male in the family.
Yeah.
You know, I think that...
I mean, ideally... Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, never mind. I was just going to say, I mean, yeah, it's when it... If it can be sort of 50-50, which I feel like ours is, that's cool.
Absolutely.
Like, if it's not, like, just the mom or... Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, of course. I mean, I think if you can achieve a balance, and I think you will... And that's the thing. I think you will if... You don't bring isms into it because ultimately I think what we've found is that where you are weak, I can be strong.
Mm-hmm.
And where I'm weak, you can be strong. Where you can do things that I can't do, then you will do them. And where I can do things that you can't do, I will do them. And also,
where are you weak and I'm strong?
Well, by that I mean like, well, okay, for instance, you'll notice that when our children need to be comforted because they have stubbed their toe or they're scared.
Mm-hmm.
They run to you
mm-hmm.
every time. They don't run to me for that. So that's where you are strong and I am mm-hmm. weak. That's not, I don't mean weak in the way that like, oh, I should be able to. It's how they're moving.
Yeah.
So that's your strength to them.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by weak and strong.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I would say, I mean, if we get, you know, there are a lot of things vis-a-vis our house and our business and the daily operations of our life that you are much better at than I am. And there are things that I'm better at than you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so we give way to each other to say, well, I think that's for you to do. You do that best. I do this, but you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Yeah.
That's also weak and strong.
Yeah.
I mean, my inability to deal with numbers and paper and forms and rules and, mm-hmm. you know, that's a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
When I was younger, there was this, was conservative at the time, stuff about the importance of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear this all the time, of the fatherless homes. There are neighborhoods in America where 80% of the homes are single mothers. And conservatives have been saying for a long time that that is a problem. And when I used to hear that and I was a young liberal, I thought, shut your damn mouth, you stupid old patriarchal hick.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I think I was wrong. I think I was wrong. Now, yeah. I think that there needs to be some edits to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just going to be flat out true that if you can have two parents in a house, that's going to be better than one.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, if you have two parents in a house, the whole thing ultimately falls into good cop, bad cop.
Mm-hmm.
And you need a good cop and a bad cop.
Yeah.
There can't be law and order without a good cop and a bad cop. It's hardwired into nature, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that can be two women. That can be two men. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
It tends to generally be to be a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the heterosexual thing. But, you know, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, like, I've learned that, you know, that really is. But I come from a history of divorce. My family's riddled with divorce. Yours is not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So where are we at? I mean, I think I think there's something right now going on with post-liberalism and Trumpism that is definitely a reaction against feminism,
mm-hmm.
a reaction against the feminization of the cultural space. Women have risen, which honestly I think is a great thing. I think everybody should rise and everybody should. I just think it's the isms that are a problem, and I think it's also that you know. Nothing is really anything minus the collaboration of the sexes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on the female side, you have feminism, and on the male side, you have masculinism. And both are basically an attempt to say, my way goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and again, feminism is just a reaction against father knows best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That whole thing. Right?
Yeah.
But like Nietzsche's inversion of Platonism is not non-Platonism.
Mm-hmm.
The inversion of the patriarchy is not non-patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. I interviewed a conservative artist for like the first time yesterday, a couple of days ago. And she said to me, she like practically whispered it. She was like, well, you know, women have been really mean to me, essentially. Like I don't. I mean, she was basically saying, which is something I've said as well, as a supposed, because she thinks I'm a feminist artist, you know. And I had to tell her, well, you know, feminists hate me too. I mean, some feminists like me, some hate me. But it was the first time I'd heard another artist, maybe even another person, actually say that out loud, and it took someone who had been canceled, who considers herself a feminist artist, to even just say that out loud.
Yeah.
It's something I've been saying for a while, but it's not a common, it's weird. Do you hear it? I don't know.
Do you what?
Like feminism is just so, it's so like seen as just perfect that like there it's,
yeah,
it's not the whole fact so, that so, it's just,
yes,
yeah, you the know, patriarchy so, in a new form so is like every, not
every,
talked about.
Every boy, every man knows what it is to be enmeshed in the world of men, where the rules of what a man is are strict and enforced, and it's pretty unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what was really going on as like gay guys started to be more public.
Mm-hmm.
40, 50 years ago. That was what was so awful about that time, is that, you know, you're not a man.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to kick your ass. We're going to spit on you. We're going to kill you. We're going to tie you to the back of our truck and drag it. You know, it's just on and on.
Mm-hmm.
That's masculinism, mm-hmm. is the rules of what it is to be a man. And if you break those rules, you're going to be mocked and ridiculed and probably maybe even hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that feminism is immune to that thing is a badass joke.
Yeah.
it's the exact same thing. It's just women totally. Doing it.
To other women.
And it's not talked about. It's why feminism is awful.
Mm-hmm.
For the same reason as, you know, manliness is awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I really want to make clear that, you know, I don't think post-liberalism is at all a man's game or a more manly version of the world, or just an erasure of feminism so that now there's masculinism. That's not at all what it is. It's really, I think post-liberalism, because, you know, again, in the liberal era, we lived under masculinism for a long time. Patriarchy and liberalism were synonymous for a long time. And now matriarchy and feminism and liberalism are synonymous. But this is because liberalism is like a cyst that just keeps returning, but in different forms. And that cyst is called identitarianism. Mm-hmm. And at different points in history, one identity becomes dominant, but it's all within the realm of supporting identities. Identities support identities, and then one identity becomes dominant, and then the other identities tear it down, and then another identity comes dominant, and they all just keep going round and round and round. So what is post-identity? What is non-identity? And again, I would say that, you know, our marriage, our family, there's something non-identitarian about it. Mm-hmm. And that's because you and I come together in the conversation of what this family should be. Our instincts and our experiences are brought to the table, but there's a lack of identity in it. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of identitarianism. There's a lack of abstract principles of what I should be or it should be because I am me and I have more power. There's not a power game in it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it might be as just corny and simple as, like, you know, I have given my identity over to you and you have given yours over to me. So we have both kind of, we're both playing with a willful non-identity in conjoining our wills and our intentions and our instincts into a long conversation of what is best in reality. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I heard these women talking about sleep training. I thought, you know, in reality, what you should be doing is talking with your partner and coming face to face with the fact that, well, you know, what is best. And I hear you, you know, they're all kind of making these like deep, heavy sacrifices in basically, you know, sleep depriving themselves day after day after day and going insane, all for this idea that it's somehow injurious to their child for the child to sleep alone. And it's like, you need to come together and like look at the realities, look at the facts, I guess.
Yeah, I think, I think that's well said. And I think, though, I don't know, I think you're right. Like, there's this element of giving up identity to each other. But I think, I don't know, I wonder if there's like, when you give up identity, then it's like, where are you? And the other person isn't always there to, like, I don't know, talk to. Obviously, you still need to know where you are. Like sleep training our daughter, right? Like, you taught her where she was. I feel like there might be a little of that in, for me, and that when I let go of all these identities, all these things that we've been so used to, I'm kind of not sure where it is anymore. Because if you're not your identity, then what are you?
Yeah, you know, that's important. And, you know, I've been kind of toying in the last couple of days with this idea of what I call systemics. And it's kind of like, I mean, I'm thinking of it in a political term. You know, so let me circle through something and then back to that. You know, what's happening right now in the political world is that the woke left and it's called the horseshoe theory. Mm-hmm. The woke right has emerged just in the last few months, right? I mean, it's been there for a while, but it's now sort of become evident and loud. It's the woke right. So there was the woke left for a long time, and now there's the woke right. What is the woke right? Well, it's just basically rabid identitarianism coming from the right. Mm. So it's pro certain identities that the woke left are anti, but it's extremely identitarian. And the woke left and the woke right are now kind of circling everybody who's stuck in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. And because they're both identitarian, I started to kind of wonder, like, so what's left if you want to abandon identitarianism? And so you're not woke left, but you're repulsed by woke right. So what are you, you know? And so, you know, I started to think, like, well, maybe there's like orders of identity. And that's why I call it systemics. Like, I feel like there's a political, philosophical outlook that basically is dedicated to what I would call a post-liberal, non-identitarian, minimalist democracy approach to the civil life, that eschews the woke left and the woke right and is essentially dedicated to the development of a system that does not preference or even take into consideration identities. Now, in other words, it treats all people exactly the same. It doesn't take their identitarian markers into account for how they should be treated, distributed to, considered, blah, blah, blah. Then I thought, you know, yes, but in any system, a system is composed of identities. And you kind of can't get away from a system recognizing that when input A occurs, then A is A, and A is not something else, right? Like, at a very systematics level, systems rely on identities. But there are first order, second order, third order identities. And when we talk about identitarianism, we talk about identity and giving up identity, and we talk about feminism as an identity, and we talk about ideals and values and meanings as an identity, and we talk about liberalism as the perpetuation of identities, I think we're using the same word to talk about different things. Mm-hmm. I think identity has become such a catchword that, like, the first, I would say, important semantic split that we need to make is between self and identity, mm-hmm. which, as I've said before, have become synonymous, but they are not synonymous. Mm-hmm. And so when I say something like the cliche of when two people fall in love, they give up their identities, and then you say to me, well, but then what's left? And the answer is yourself.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't hit right away, because it's like, well, wait a minute, what? Like, identity, self? Well, actually, what we've let go, and I almost say this is parallel and synonymous to Heidegger's claim that we have been abandoned by being, and we have abandoned the task of understanding being and the truth of being. I would just contemporize that with, we have abandoned the self because we consider the self synonymous with an identity, but self and identity are actually completely different things. Mm. And you only gain a self when you lose your identity. Yeah. And when you have an identity, your self is suppressed and erased and demoted. And so, I mean, the question is obviously then, we've talked a lot about what identity is, what is the self? Well, the self is you know, the human being, in a sense, it's Dasein. It's the human being who is in flight from identity. It's hard to talk about what non-identity is and being in a state of non-identity, but I think we can talk about a movement away from identity, mm-hmm. and ask what that is. And when that movement away from identity begins, then the self begins. And the self is instinctual. The self is non-ismic. The self is non-liberal. The self is non-platonic. The self is immediate. The self is bang. The self is an event. The self is a phenomenal moment of awareness. You know, we can go on and on. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's just words, because it's really, you know, this is new, this idea that there's a difference between identity and self. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's partly what I've encapsulated into scalps, sameness, mm-hmm. category, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, that identity does all those things and enslaves the self, mm-hmm. to those paradigms. Mm-hmm. And so... so I would say go back to this experience of you and me. Mm-hmm. What we have gained by giving up our identity, which really means our liberal ideology, mm-hmm. in coming together and making our being together a conversation, we have gained ourselves. Mm-hmm. Free of the identitarianism that our culture continually convinces us is the only way to be.
Yeah.
Now, that said, there can be some vertigo, right, mm-hmm. in having this so-called self. But I would say that's because this is the other beginning. This is the work that Heidegger is calling us to. This is the post-liberal program, the non-identitarian program. We haven't, and this is the guiding question and the basic question.
And the interplay, the section.
That's right.
The interplay is literally going from the first beginning
yes,
to the
that's
other
right.
beginning.
What is that self? What is the self? What is the self we gain when identity is eschewed? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a vacuum there. Mm-hmm. That's the abandonment by being. Mm-hmm. The self has been abandoned, and it's been neglected, and it's been ignored. Yeah. Because identity is a parasite that takes over everything. Yeah. And identity is so good, like liberalism, at marketing its lies. It's convinced us, its core mission has been to say, you know what, the self, that self thing that I know you've heard about, that doesn't even exist. It does exist, but let's just call it identity. Mm-hmm. You just need to get online and you need to Google identity and self and start looking at everything from the Harvard Review to Psychology Today to the American Psychiatric Association. Identity and self are used interchangeably. Mm. There's no zero liberal academic attention to the idea that they might be different things, mm-hmm. because identity has taken over. Mm-hmm. And it's that movement towards sameness, categorization, labeling, projection, anonymity, the identitarian regime of platonic forms that control representation and the whole directionality of questioning that is liberalism and that has destroyed our understanding of what a self might be. But that feeling I think you get when you're with me and we're together and we're doing things, and that feeling of like, wow, this is real, this is happening. My instincts and my ambitions and my interests are becoming realized in this project and this togetherness and this life that I'm making with this person. That is yourself. There it is. It's happening right there. And you know, you say, oh, I'm not always there. Yes, I am. Yeah. I'm just sleep training you. And I'm trying to introduce you to yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, a child never fully sleeps in the absence of a longing for its mother. That does not go away.
Yeah, well said.
Well, I guess that's it. Unless you want to say something.
No, that's well said. That was very, yeah, that was powerful. Powerfully said.
Yeah. Done? All right, good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.